Support for WVIA Pop Shop comes from the F.M. Kirby Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Wilkes-Barre, presenting concerts, comedy, family entertainment, and community events in a historic theater. Information and upcoming events at kirbycenter.org.
So, Patrick,
yes.
there's a new Christopher Nolan film out.
Is
which,
there?
Yes, which means we have to revive what always comes with a Christopher Nolan release.
Mm-hmm.
The debates, the arguments, the impassioned pleas about what is the best or your favorite
yes.
Nolan film. Do you have a favorite?
I have two, actually.
Okay, fair enough, because then I might pick two as well.
I'm very split between Memento and The Prestige.
Memento seems like a film made almost precisely for you,
yeah.
Sort of a postmodern literary critic.
Yeah, but Prestige has that element as well. Prestige is also based on a novel that I really, really love, too.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I tend to forget that Prestige is a Nolan film.
Yeah.
But yeah, I probably go back and forth between those two as my favorite.
I think Nolan is a postmodern filmmaker.
Mm.
Hits a lot of notes, probably.
Yeah.
So for me, there's two I go back and forth between
okay.
as well. And the first is like such a basic answer as a historian.
Obviously, The Dark Knight.
Not The Dark Knight, surprisingly. Oppenheimer.
Okay.
It's historical. It asks big moral questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only Nolan film I've ever seen in IMAX.
Okay.
And it was an experience on a different level
okay.
to do it that way. But several years ago, I watched Interstellar with hope.
Mm.
And it's such a father-daughter
mm-hmm.
story. And when it was done, we went and we sat out on the driveway on a nice summer day like today. And Hope said, as she was like looking up in the clouds, that the movie made the world feel more real.
Mm.
And I thought, that's a pretty good endorsement
okay.
of a film. Karen, do you have a favorite?
Nolan film?
Mm-hmm.
I would say this one. That we're going to be talking
really?
About now. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if we were ranking The Odyssey in this list or not. I was
going to say not because that's going to kind of be the question that we'll answer in the rest of the show.
Okay, but I mean, Kara has answered. So, best Nolan film ever. Okay.
Did I do it wrong?
Sorry. No.
No. That's totally fine.
Not at all. It's a bold claim and it's a great way to set up what's coming next.
Yes.
On The Pop Shop. Hi, I'm Alan Austin.
And I am Patrick Hamilton.
Welcome to Pop Shop. Here, stories on the screen inspire conversations about the real world off of it.
Today, we'll be asking the muses for inspiration as we talk about the latest Christopher Nolan film, The Odyssey. Does it live up to the epic proportions of the original text, or is it going to take divine intervention to get audiences to see it?
Oof. As always, if you're enjoying the program, please like, subscribe, turn on those old notifications so you don't miss a moment.
And WVIA's Pop Shop is sponsored by the FM Kirby Center, and we'll be talking with Gene from there in just a little bit.
But I think, Patrick, before Gene shows up, we have a couple of minutes where we can talk about Christopher Nolan's latest blockbuster, The Odyssey.
Yes, which of course adapts the ancient Greek epic poem by Homer, which details Odysseus's long journey home back to Ithaca following the end of the Trojan War. It's a journey fraught with perils to Odysseus and his men, but also all is not well back in Ithaca, as his wife and queen Penelope and son Telemachus face unruly suitors pursuing the throne as Odysseus is believed dead due to his long absence.
And that is a lot to pack into a movie, which is the same thing Nolan does with actors. This film stars Matt Damon and literally what seems like a cast of thousands. Matt Damon obviously shows up as the title character, Odysseus, upon, you know, whose journey we're going to follow. His wife, Penelope, is played by Anne Hathaway. Tom Holland appears as his son,
Telemachus.
Telemachus, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Pattinson does quite a scene-stealing set of work as the villain and very, very creepy Atenuas.
I think that's how it's pronounced.
Okay.
Something like that. It's close.
I like that since I said it, you assume it's probably not right.
I can't remember how to pronounce it either.
100%.
But I think you're close.
Totally fair. And so it is with them and then a huge mm-hmm. list of other people as well that we begin this journey. And we thought we would begin our journey here mm-hmm. today by thinking about the film as an adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
So my understanding, and you're the literary critic,
okay.
so you can fine tune this for me a mm-hmm. little bit. But an adaptation ought to transform and kind of reinterpret source material in a way that maintains the essence of it,
mm-hmm.
but does something perhaps new. I feel like I didn't get that right.
No, I mean, that's certainly one kind of adaptation. But there are also, there's also the more strict view of adaptation, which is that you're supposed to do what the book does. That, you know, an adaptation of film should just be kind of the book on film. Obviously, Nolan leans much more into the first camp, particularly with this film.
Isn't it sort of impossible, though, to put a book on film? To take a book word for word and page for page and turn it into a movie?
I mean, there's always some element of adaptation to it. I mean, you're particularly for a longer book, you're never going to get the whole book on page. I think of, like, The Lord of the Rings. And even The Odyssey.
Good Lord.
There's a lot of The Odyssey that gets condensed.
Right.
Because the original poem has a very kind of episodic nature, and a lot of those episodes kind of get a little bit repetitive, particularly if you see them on film. So Nolan does kind of condense, kind of does a kind of the greatest hits of the various kind of scenes in The Odyssey, particularly related to Odysseus'
journey. I think
that's
an apt description of what he's doing. Now, are you like Nolan or are you unlike Nolan? Do you prefer something that's truer to the original?
That's a good question. I mean, I would say I'm probably more in the Nolan camp.
Yeah.
As long as it's true to the spirit of the text.
Yes.
When you adapt something, maybe the one place where that broke down for me was with the adaptation of White Noise, because that's my absolute favorite book, and I ran into some problems seeing that one.
Yeah, that's fair.
But yeah, I think that it's important to be faithful to the spirit, maybe not so much to the letter.
Yeah, fair enough. And I totally agree. I think you probably know that. I prefer giving the artist a lot of leeway to try to remain true to the spirit of it. Yeah. You may know I have a big complaint with The Grapes of Wrath as a film because I feel as if the ending really violates the spirit of the novel.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to give people a lot of leeway with Steinbeck, but the core of it needs to be there.
It's the same thing with what was the adaptation of The Scarlet Letter back in the day with Demi Moore that kind of, I never saw it, but my understanding is it kind of ended with a happy ending, which is not the ending of Scarlet Letter at all.
It's a pretty fundamental misunderstanding of Hawthorne, I think, to imagine happy endings. So where are you on this? Because I think if I'm building off your idea that it needs to be true to the spirit, I think Nolan has done something really interesting here that captures some of the spirit of the original, but really makes this a film so much about today.
Yeah, so on the one hand, I like what he did, particularly in terms of, kind of the larger theme and kind of connecting everything back to the end of the Trojan War and kind of the way in which that kind of becomes the explanation for everything that happens.
Yeah.
The issue is that we don't really get to that until the end of the film.
Yeah.
And so there was a big jump, particularly when we're detailing Odysseus's journey. There was a lot of it that felt very checklisty to me in terms of like, oh, we're going to do the Cyclops and we've got Scylla and Charybdis and we've got Circe and like we're kind of checking those off. And I felt like we were kind of going through the motions a little bit for me.
So the idea that it was a checklist, I felt that a little bit too. But I thought saving the Troy reveal for the end had real power because I think one of the things Nolan wants to do with this movie In the way in which you were talking about before we went to see it, they're speaking American English.
Yeah.
Right? That the Odyssey is about Odysseus, but it's really about us today. That this is a warning about the collapse of civilization. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, we imagine that a civilization collapses, it's very dramatic and overnight. Mm-hmm. It's like one day you're selling your wares in Pompeii and the next day you're covered in ash. Mm-hmm. But instead, what really happens to civilizations is they erode gradually over time. And it's only, Penelope and those around her who are beginning to recognize the end of civilization in this film. And that twist on Troy that I want to come back to when we can move past spoilers, I think works really well for the way in which I believe Nolan wants to use this movie to critique government, that structures are only as good as the people who inhabit them, the way he wants us to critique people and especially the people we see as our heroes, that we live in a time, much like Homer did when he wrote this, where the social bonds that knit people together were fraying.
Yeah.
And I think that Nolan actually, I obviously picked The Odyssey for a very specific reason. I think he sees it as speaking very profoundly to our time.
Yeah, and I do like, the more I think about it, particularly after seeing the film, I do like where he ends up. I just think some of that or some of that should have been earlier on, particularly in terms of explaining kind of what was going on with Odysseus and his men as they're traveling. Because there's ways that I think we could have had a better explanation for the relationship between Odysseus and his men if that had been earlier, or if other things that happened in the Odyssey had been left.
Fair.
I think there's some explanation there that's kind of missing a little bit.
I think the trade-off for that is the gut punch you get at the end if you haven't been paying attention, you know, that the people on the seas are this huge danger, right? And we won't give away because no spoilers until the second half of the show. But when you realize the truth of the film, when you realize where the corruption comes from and where the decline comes from, that I think it worked dramatically very well.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nolan is always going to play with time and fracture it in different kinds of ways, I think, to tell the story. But,
and that's actually the way the Odyssey works. I've seen some people complaining about Nolan's kind of fracturing of time, but the Odyssey actually starts in pretty much the exact same place that the movie starts, which is with Telemachus, you know, dealing with the suitors right at the beginning, and then we kind of learn everything in flashback. It's actually one of the elements that I would say Nolan is actually not really messing with things as much as he might usually be thought of, because the Odyssey is actually, again, it's the typical form of the epic. It begins in the middle of things, and then you sort of get caught up on what's going on.
So let me ask you a quick question, because you know the Odyssey better than me. I've probably not read it since high school.
I have not read it since high school either. So.
One of the things that struck me that I don't remember from the Odyssey is the idea that they fought the war for Helen, but not really for Helen. Mm-hmm. That Helen is the ideal that's presented. Mm-hmm. Like, we're fighting a war for Helen, but as somebody says, it was really about trade routes and trade dominance.
Yeah.
That Helen is just pretext for what is a much greedier kind of Greek empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember. Okay. And some of it might depend, too. I mean, the translation I would have read probably was the Lattimore translation, particularly of the Iliad. And particularly for the Iliad and the Odyssey, there's much more of a triumphant sense of things in, I think, both of those texts. And I don't know that more modern... Because I think Nolan's working with more recent translations, and I don't know if that's there. But that's one of the major changes he makes, is that there's not this kind of critique of the Trojan War as much in the Odyssey, and particularly in the Iliad.
And that's the transition I want to make to the second half, where we can actually talk about the Trojan War with spoilers. But before we can get to the spoilers, we have Gene coming in.
Yes, from the Kirby Center to talk to us about what's going on there. And we're here with Gene from the Kirby again to tell us everything that's going on there.
So, Gene, what's happening?
So, tomorrow we're showing Sentimental Value. It's an awesome independent film. It's part of our Curtis Montz film series. Every summer we have this film series. We try to show the best in documentary, independent, and foreign film. And I think we do a pretty good job of curating that series. And then next Tuesday we're showing Trolls during our big screen summer series. It's sponsored by Honesdale National Bank. Thank you. We show one every Tuesday through August 11th, and it's only $5 for anyone 13 and over, but it's free for anyone 12 and under. So come down, see a movie, get out of the heat. And before that, come to United Way of Wyoming Valley's Camp United.
So I've not seen Trolls. So where does it rank for you among sort of the more recently produced?
I've seen its sequel, Troll 2, but I haven't seen the original.
So you can follow Troll 2 without seeing Troll 1?
I mean, that's a story. Okay. What leads a man to see Troll 2 when they've not seen the first?
I didn't know there was a sequel until recently, honestly.
And you just stumbled into it. So, interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am very excited for Sentimental Value, because that's one I haven't seen yet. I didn't get a chance to see when it was getting its Oscar buzz, so I'm very excited to see that at the Kirby.
Yeah. It's so great to have a theater in the local area that allows you to see some of the less mainstream, some might say like superhero MCU stuff. It's like so taken over the theaters. It's nice to have like a respite.
I agree. Yeah. Cinema is one of my passions for sure. So it's nice to work at a place that values that just as much as I do.
Yeah. It's a real gift to the community. For sure.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So thanks for being here, Gene.
Yeah. Thank you guys for having us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Gene.
Yep. And so we'll continue our discussion of the Odyssey by moving into kind of talking about the mythology of the film, and in particular the way in which heroes in this film and maybe in Nolan more generally are mythologized.
Absolutely. And just a moment to talk about the visuals of this film that are absolutely stunning. The way in which You didn't go for it.
I did not feel it as much.
To me, the way that he uses nature to capture the hubris of men, mm-hmm. as well as the insignificance of men.
Yeah.
Often, especially the scenes on the water, there's a moment where they go into the cave, mm-hmm. and almost the entire screen is blackened. I just think there were moments that worked, but not for you.
I think for me the moment was with Scylla and Charybdis, in that I'm like, oh, yep, that's a whirlpool. It didn't kind of have, like, the majesty that I was kind of hoping it would have.
But what about all the rest? It was the natural world that really struck me, not the constructed world.
Yeah, for me, I think it was more some of the more mythological elements of the film didn't have as much oomph to them. It's one of the places where I think maybe Nolan's kind of realism as a filmmaker might have gotten in the way of some of the more... mythological, magical things kind of having a little bit more presence.
I can see that. Yeah. Especially Scylla and Charybdis is a moment where both the whirlpool and the monster seem...
The monster I felt a little bit better about. I wanted the whirlpool to be a little bit more.
It was all the other stuff. It was the realism that struck me. So if I start thinking about Odysseus, though, mm-hmm. as sort of the hero in the myth here, mm-hmm. this is really a story about his hubris, about his pride, about his overconfidence. And the film then undermines how I always thought of Odysseus. I don't know how, as a kid, he's just the hero of the story. He's just this really undaunted guy who kind of outfights and outthinks whatever comes his way. And here, though, we revise our understanding of Troy, that he designs the idea of the Trojan horse. He gets the Greeks inside. Mm-hmm. And then what I've never thought about when I've read the Odyssey is what happens to the people inside the gates.
Yeah.
That you see what are essentially a series of war crimes and atrocities being carried out.
Yeah.
And so in this way, all of a sudden, that was the gut punch for me in the film, that what we imagine to be a hero isn't a hero.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting things, because obviously one of the major points that gets emphasized in the film is what he refers to as Zeus's Law, which basically refers to the idea, which is very important in the Odyssey, of host and guest relations, that the Odyssey sort of encodes how hosts and guests are supposed to behave.
Right.
The suitors are bad guests. You know, the Cyclops is a bad host.
Right.
That doesn't really, in the Odyssey, get extended to the Trojan War itself.
Yeah.
And that's something that I see Nolan doing, is that the Trojan War itself, and in particular, the Trojan horse trick, which is obviously what clever Odysseus comes up with, is kind of the ultimate violation of... Zeus's law, and thus why this civilization kind of has to end.
But also,
which I found really brilliant in the way the film did that.
It's a code of honor that they claim all the time until they don't.
Yeah.
There's a moment where they need to get food and supplies, and they just pillage a place.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's okay for us to do it because we're the Greeks. And this is how I think Nolan's arguing civilizations are decline and are ultimately kind of eat themselves. Mm-hmm. At one point, Odysseus says about the sack of Troy, when we destroyed Troy, we destroyed the world.
Yes.
That the corruption of the people with power is what is going to destroy the world, ultimately. I just thought it was very brilliantly done in that way. That we just celebrate our heroes because, of course, when we write these epic poems and we sing these songs about them, we turn them into Batman. Or we turn them into other kinds of characters. We turn them into something that's removed from the actual human experience. Mm-hmm. And what so much of our history would instruct us is true of humans.
Well, you mentioned Batman. It's one of the things that's really interesting, particularly towards the end of the film. Mm-hmm. Odysseus, Nolan's Odysseus, kind of becomes a blend of Oppenheimer and Batman. Mm. In that he's Oppenheimer in the sense that he did something that does lead to the end of his civilization in the same way that Oppenheimer created something that threatens our civilization.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, we get the big hero moment with him fighting the suitors that is very sort of Batman-esque.
To me, that was my least favorite part of the film. I thought it just felt way overwrought, way overdone. We didn't need it. In fact, if you want to establish Odysseus's sort of jerkiness, the way in which he returns and puts everybody through their paces as he pretends to be a beggar seems like... overplanned a little bit.
To be fair, that is exactly what happens in the Odyssey.
I don't doubt that.
Like, that is...
Not doubting it, but on screen, that was the part that lagged most for me. But thinking of Oppenheimer, I think the comparison is clear. They're both men who had this great idea. Now, obviously, Oppenheimer wasn't his idea alone, but he becomes kind of the figure.
The symbol of it,
that pulls it all together. And they both then carry this tremendous war guilt. Like, there's, if there's one scene from Oppenheimer that's probably why it's my favorite film, it's the film after the bomb has been detonated in Japan, and they have what's almost like a pep rally in what looks like a school gymnasium. It must have been a gym they'd built at Los Alamos or whatever. Yeah. And halfway through, as they're celebrating, Oppenheimer imagines all of them being obliterated by an atomic blast, where the war guilt that Odysseus is carrying with him is a guilt that Oppenheimer carries with him for the rest of his life. And both of them face consequences for that.
Yeah, it's then that's where I think the early parts of the film don't quite work as well for me, because Odysseus doesn't have his memory.
Yeah.
And is recovering his memory for much of the film. He also doesn't have that guilt for much of the film early on. And I think I would have liked to have seen that earlier.
Interesting.
Particularly in the one change to the Cyclops scene, which is that as they're leaving...
Yeah.
You know, the Cyclops doesn't know who's killed him or who's wounded him. And you know, they can get away free. And then Odysseus has to boast that it was I, Odysseus, that did this to you.
Yeah.
And that brings Poseidon's punishment on them. And that that would have given a better explanation for why the men are sort of dissatisfied with Odysseus as they're traveling and kind of seeing that as it goes along. Because we don't see that as much... So, in the journey as Odysseus recollects it.
I wonder if that's the trade-off that Nolan made to trade a little bit of the in-story for the out-story message he wants to create. Because I think it does work very well as that punch in the gut at the end.
It does.
That you might not see coming, but I can see your point as well. But you mentioned Batman.
Yes.
And I was saying to Kara before the show started that for a moment, when I walked out of this film, I said, I wonder if I need to reconsider... The way I think about Nolan's treatment of the Batman.
Oh, wow.
Because I think in some ways he's saying the same thing, right? Batman is a guy that probably has too much confidence and too much pride. He imagines he can harness everything to his own will and build a better world. And there are drastic consequences around those he loves and society around him for his choices. And so I wonder if Nolan was trying to say a similar thing about Batman. The problem is... Batman kind of gets let off the hook in the end. He gets a happy ending. He gets to hang out with Catwoman in a sort of Parisian cafe or whatever.
Yes.
So.
Well, you just got to imagine that's where Odysseus and Penelope are going on their boat. It's kind of the same ending.
We should write that. Like they show up at the cafe.
It is just kind of the same
Bruce
ending.
Bruce and Selina.
The problem is that it's the same actors playing Catwoman and playing Penelope. So it's a little hard to film that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, with AI, I'm sure Kara would say you could film anything.
We're not
going to
advocate the use of AI on this show.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think
absolutely not.
I don't think Batman feels Nolan's Batman. I don't think feels as he doesn't have the same guilt that Odysseus has.
And I think you're right. Like, so it made me.
Nor does the film, I think, want us to see him as guilty.
It
in the
made
same
me
way.
Rethink if maybe I wasn't seeing what Nolan wanted me to see in that film.
Mm.
But the ultimate problem might be genre. That the superhero in particular is very difficult to maybe end there. Although you're kind of arguing that he has the same problem with the Odyssey as well, that Odysseus, do you think he gets off too easy or?
No, I think within the logic of the film, it kind of makes sense. I mean, because largely when he and Penelope are sailing off to the West, I think basically it is kind of they're sailing off to death. And that they're sort of done and in that way they're kind of paying or Odysseus at least is kind of paying the price. He's gonna go and honor the dead that he didn't honor in the past.
Right.
And so I don't know that it lets him off too easy.
Yeah.
In the same way that maybe it lets Batman off too easy.
So to Penelope real quickly, what a tragedy for her, because she gives that speech. I've been sitting on the throne for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, like I've been holding this all together in some way or other. And even when Odysseus gets home, she still just has to go do what he's doing.
Yeah.
Right? That there is no real escape, I guess, for
Penelope. Well, and in terms of the idea that the old world is ending, that's not as clean when the son of Odysseus is still the king.
Right. And we know, in fact, that this is, you know, the beginning of the end in many ways for our culture. And a warning that Nolan is trying to send us, I think, across the ages to think about maybe where we live today. Which means there's only one thing left to do.
Yeah, I think so.
Take this... 3-hour-long film full of really complicated themes and myths, chock full of star, actors, made by one of the biggest directors in the world,
yeah,
and boil it down to one of two words.
That's right.
It either pops
or shops.
Pops means we really like it.
That's
everybody
right.
Everybody should go see it. It has the show's endorsement. Shops means we would suggest that you pass on it and shop for something else, right?
Yes.
And this seems totally fair, right?
Oh, it's totally fair. Yes.
Like anything complicated in this world can be reduced to an either or kind of answer.
Everything's 100%. Very binary.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Like, as our show demonstrates.
Of course.
I can't. Sometimes I'm surprised we do this still. All right. So is it my turn to go first? I can't remember.
I think it's Patrick.
Okay, Patrick. Yeah.
So I am. I'm probably a very slight pop.
I cannot.
I'm not as. I just. You know. Okay. Why do I keep? There we go. I'm going to give it a pop.
Okay.
But it's not. It's not as good as I was kind of hoping.
I thought you were going to do my half and half.
I was. As we've been talking about it, I'm leaning more towards pop.
You're
but
so
it's
critical. You're so critical of my doing that.
It is. But, it is a little bit
so
kind of in between for me.
Pop minus.
Yeah, it's probably a pop minus. Or,
Don't feel shy putting a pop minus on there.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, but I'm a little there's just I think there's a way that the film could have been structured a little bit differently.
Okay.
I agree with you that you know the gut punch at the end does work really well, but I think there's a way that you could have had some of that earlier in the film, and not sacrifice that gut punch. Like you could have had things framed more around Odysseus and his sins early on, and then kind of had that feed into the larger sins of the civilization he represents. And I just feel like without that, there's something lacking in the first part of the film for me.
Okay, fair enough. So for me, I've never given any movie, I don't think, this rating. So I've come up with a new one.
Oh, Lord.
I'm giving it a pop.
That's not new.
It's new for me. I never give just a pop. It's always a pop plus,
pretty sure
a pop minus.
In the previous iteration of the show, you have given pops.
Oh, that's probably true. But this season, never before seen with a paddle.
Uh-huh.
I think it's a pop.
Okay.
I think it's a very good movie.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. It kind of reminded me of the epics of my childhood where you'd see the really bad claymation sort of creatures.
I miss those.
Right? And
the Harryhausen.
Yeah. I liked that quality. In that way, Scylla and Charybdis didn't bother me quite as much, although I can see your criticism of them. I think that it's a really important theme thematically.
Yes.
I think Nolan is doing really interesting things with history to try to help us use history to better understand where we are today and maybe try to help us understand where we sit as a civilization. So I think it's all very, very good. I don't think it's the best Nolan film, though.
No.
Like, I'm not quite as enthusiastic as Kara.
Yep.
It would be middle, I think, for me, but it's not quite Oppenheimer.
In Kara's defense,
yeah,
it is the best Nolan film based on Rotten Tomatoes ratings right now.
It's killing, right?
96 and 97.
So let's hope it makes a lot of money to remind people to go to the stinking theater and see these films. So,
Kara,
how are you feeling?
I think Kara has a paddle now.
I do. I am popping.
Okay.
I'm popping it. I'm putting the extra P-I-N-G in there.
I was just going to say,
with the exclamation mark. I said previously to Alan, I'm not necessarily into the literature or the mythology to have any deep thought on that. But for the film itself, it really felt epic to me. It felt like an epic tale, you know, from the monsters to the witch to the gods. I felt like this piece of literature was being read out loud to me in the theater. The film had this like poetic rhythm, and I really felt enthralled in it. The Odyssey gives you, I think, all the feelings, you know, the suspense, the longing, the hopelessness, the trickery, the the religion, the betrayal, everything, and the vengeance. It had it all, and I think Nolan curated it in a way that it just felt balanced and nuanced and meaningful for me. I truly, and Anne Hathaway, I'm saying it now.
Yeah.
She's getting an Oscar for this. I mean, her portrayal as Penelope, one of a kind, for sure.
Yeah. There was some real humanity in the performances that stood out and were needed to make the film work. So I think as a show then, we're agreeing that it pops.
Yeah, I think overall,
we should go see it. Or you should go
see it. I think people should go see it, yeah.
Yeah. So
Yes, and so, that brings us to the end of this episode of Pop Shop.
It sadly does.
If you liked what you saw and or heard, you know, feel free to like the episode, subscribe to the show, and turn on notifications so you never miss an episode of Pop Shop.
Yeah, and thanks so much for joining us, and thanks, as always, to the FM Kirby Center for its sponsorship of our show.
That's right, and next week we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to take a break from talking about a single show to do a little bit of work on... talking about some trailers of upcoming films, The End of Oak Street, One Night Only, and HBO's Lantern series. We're going to talk about some viewer comments. And we're also going to announce some changes to the show, so you definitely don't want to miss that.
Come join the party.
Support for WVIA Pop Shop comes from the FM Kirby Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Wilkes-Barre, presenting concerts, comedy, family entertainment, and community events in a historic theater. Information and upcoming events at kirbycenter.org.